Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hi, welcome to the first episode of Series 4 of The Political Football, a podcast series from These Football Times. It's great to be back with you again. Football is a global phenomenon. People who follow it can fall into an obsessive mindset where victory or defeat for their national or club team can define their lives, attitudes and understanding of the world around them, both locally and globally. Over time, and in so many places around the world though, the game's ability to intoxicate and elicit unquestioning devotion to a cause has often been manipulated by states, parties or other political organisations and indeed individuals seeking a way to persuade, influence and increase their power by using football as a political tool. This series looks at examples of such scenarios, considers their context, cause and effect, and how the game has been used by such political forces. It also questions whether at times football has kicked back or provided the means to counter these forces. This is The Political Football, and today we're going back in time to look at Mussolini, Italy and the 1934 World Cup. I'm Gary Thacker, and I'm delighted to be co-hosting this new series with my good friend, Stu Horsfield. How are you doing, Stu?
Hi, Gary. Good. We're back for another school day. It's been a while, let's say.
Every time we talk to a guest on these pods, as you say, it's a school day. We almost don't know the things that we didn't know. You only know the things you don't know. You don't know the things you don't know.
That's right. I've learned lots of things I didn't know.
Sorry, go on.
And I was just saying, I've learned lots that I didn't really, like you say, I didn't realise actually how much I didn't know. I seem to have learned loads of stuff that I don't know, which sounds quite bizarre. But whenever I come off after these and people ask me, oh, what have you talked about? And it's like, oh, you'll never believe it. You'll never guess. You'll never know what's happened. It's great. I love it.
It is. I mean, the guests we had on have been stupendous, mighty. And I think we've got another one lined up here. So who's our guest tonight, mate?
So our guest tonight is Aidan Williams. He admits that international football's always intrigued him more than the club game does from a global perspective rather than obviously just merely an England one. He is a Newcastle fan, which anyone who's listened to the My Side series will know that he's a staunch Newcastle fan, which is probably just as well that he gets his footballing kicks, obviously, in other ways. And as tales around the World Cup and other major international competitions have always fascinated him, obviously the rich history, but also stories of the tribulations of national teams, you know, at lower levels as well, not just the major ones. Aidan, senior writer at These Football Times, like I say, has had the chance to tell some of these tales to a wider audience. He considers it a joy and a privilege, which, you know, I think we all do. And like I said before, he's been on the occasional podcast as well. So a great guest tonight.
Indeed. So how you doing, Aidan?
Very good. Thank you. Nice to be on again. It's great.
Yeah, looking forward to this one. I mean, it's this sort of era that I sort of like getting involved in. It's the pre-war World Cups are almost sort of lost in the mist of time for so many people. And this one particularly has so many political connotations around it, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's all sorts of intrigue within the tournaments themselves, but equally so, the whole build-up and background to it all is hugely political in all sorts of ways. So there's quite a lot to delve into, I'm sure.
Okay, so let's open the box and have a look inside. So tell us what's your particular interest in this tournament and the politics of Mussolini in Italy around that.
Well, as Stu was alluding to a little bit in the intro there, so World Cups, pretty much anything associated with them, have always been my biggest footballing fascination from childhood and still is now. I mean, as a child, I was the one who had the World Cup edition of Sabutio, unlike the club edition that others had, and I always pretended to be playing out World Cups instead of the league. But maybe that was just me. But as part of that, the curiosity about some of the great stories of the World Cups in the past has probably gives me a greater fascination than more recent tournaments does. Just because of the rich history and the varied stories and things that you know, I didn't really always know about at the time. If they were ones I was watching when I was young, there's more backstories to that. Or in this case, things even further ago have got a whole host of extra stories around them. Obviously, my knowledge of the early World Cups was rather more limited than the knowledge I've got of tournaments more recently or in my youth. But obviously, on reading further for my own interests, there's all sorts of iconic stories from these pioneering days. Italy's story in particular, winning these two pre-World War II tournaments, which were the only two they entered, in fact. It would be interesting enough just from a sporting perspective, but the extra political intrigue, the whole fascist era, manipulation of sporting events for political ideals and along the same lines as the Berlin Olympics for the German Nazi regime. This makes 1934 and 1938, the Italian wins in those years, even more intriguing to me. And they also had huge influence on the actual hosting of the tournament. That's where the similarities with the Berlin Olympics, of course, come in with propaganda and promoting your country internationally and so on. There was also one or two underhand aspects alleged or strongly alleged and various bits of stories here and there about during the tournament in 34, helping them on their way to victory. And by 1938, fascism was obviously reaching its nearing its end goal, I guess, in terms of what came next. But the impact of the politics on Italy's successful defence were quite extreme in terms of how the team were perceived there and various other influences that came during that tournament as well.
Yeah, it says World Pass for it, isn't it, Stu?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
First thought, Stu?
It's funny, you know, listen to Aidan there, and obviously yourself, Guy. You know, you talk about the, you know, the sort of the early World Cups, and you know, for me, even just the World Cups, sort of from my childhood, you know, I found fascinating. But I think, you know, and we've talked about this quite a lot, Gary, and the sanitization of football now, everything's so corporate and so public relations orientated that, you know, these World Cups, certainly pre-World War II World Cups, are a, you know, they're a fascinating insight into what was happening in the world at that time, what was happening, you know, within politics around the world at that time. You know, they are, whereas now football tries to make itself quite insular and separate itself out of politics, whereas sort of pre-World War II, and you're right, when you look at the Berlin Olympics and, you know, and Hitler, but at that time, you know, sport was seen as one of those key areas where, you know, the might of a nation could be demonstrated to the, you know, to the rest of the world. And you're right, what fascinates me is how it's just a complete world away from how football and World Cups and elite level football is perceived now and to how it is then. And it's, you know, like you're right, it is a fascinating history lesson bound up in obviously football, which is what we all love.
Definitely. Just a quick question, Aidan. I mean, I, you know, the sliding doors moment. What would have happened, do you think, to the fascist doctrine if Italy hadn't triumphed in 1934? You know, I mean, obviously there was a famous moments when Jesse Owens buggered Hitler doctrine up in. So, what do you think would happen? Thank God for that. What do you think would have happened if Italy hadn't triumphed in 1934? Would it have been a big blow to Mussolini? Would it have hurt his political aspects?
No, and it's a fascinating question, isn't it? And one that we never truly know the answer to. But I guess from my point of view, I think there's two aspects to this. The first is, in terms of one of their goals from hosting the tournament was Italy's international standing and showing off the fascist advances and so on, so things that they constructed, stadiums, infrastructure and all that kind of thing, and demonstrating how organised they were. You know, there's the endless joke about trains being on time and all of that, but in terms of organising a huge tournament, that would have been a benefit regardless of what the team did. So to some extent, there would have still been those benefits, but that wouldn't have quite hit the mark as much without the team winning. So it would have taken a hit, absolutely. And some of the stories we'll come on to, it kind of demonstrates the need, if you like, for victory that kind of underpinned it all. And actually, I think that need was even more so come the following tournament in 38, because there'd been all sorts of rumours in 34 of influence and interference, to be able to successfully win it again without their own fascist state organising it became even more vital for the way Italy was perceived abroad. So as much as there were certain benefits from hosting no matter what, you're right, it wouldn't have been quite as good for the regime at all had they not won.
Yeah, Stu?
This is a question that this is my ignorance here, and I apologise. When you look at this period of the 1930s and you look at global sporting events, and you know, and the Berlin Olympics, you know, is the one that most people relate to and look back to. But I'm asking you the question in terms of the father of using sport to promote fascism. Was Mussolini the funniest thing that Hitler was in terms of the use of sport and its potential, like you say, for this global outlook that it projected?
Absolutely spot on. Yes, he was. So, in effect, you could say he pioneered some of the techniques, if you like, or various methods to actually demonstrate this power internationally through sport that the Nazi regime then took on in the 1936 Olympics. So yes, he was slightly ahead. And there was an uneasy relationship between the two. We'll see a couple of examples of how they interacted during some of these events later on. But it was slightly uneasy between the two. But most definitely, Mussolini led the way when it came to using sport for promoting the fascist ideal, and Hitler then took that on and took it in slightly further with, you know, they produced the Riefenstahl movies and all that kind of thing about 1936 that was promoting it even more so. Mussolini kicked that off with some of the various things he did promoting the 1934 World Cup, the ways of pushing it within both his own country and internationally. So some of the aspects at home would be making sure that the influence was seen as much on his own people, to bring them, unite them, if you like, behind his ideal, as much as it was to show that ideal internationally.
It's fascinating. Sorry, go on, Jerry.
No, go.
I was just going to say, it's fascinating, because obviously, you know, when I asked it's nothing I've ever really thought of before. You know, you hear the names, you know about the regime and those global events, but it's only as you were talking there, Aidan, and like I say, everything seems to be crystallised in that Berlin Olympics, but it seems like you say that actually, you know, Mussolini probably played a far bigger part in terms of, like you say, using sport as a demonstration of nationalism and power. And like I say, it's nothing that I've really thought of before, although I've been aware of both and the tournaments and the major events. It's always been quite ignorant, probably on my part, that Hitler was almost not the godfather, but the originator of the idea. But actually, you know, it actually wasn't. It was Mussolini.
Yeah, I mean, propaganda in general is obviously a key fascist tool, isn't it? It's page one of the fascist rule book, I guess, of this is what you do to promote yourself, is propagandize everything and make sure the message is always on track. But yeah, in terms of sport, this Mussolini obviously did that first.
Yeah, with that in mind, can you just sort of give us a little bit of a summary on the subject and the political context of the time then, because we spoke about Germany and Italy and pre-war, but can you give us a little bit of the political context of the time?
Yeah, so I mean, football during the fascist era in Italy underwent something of a huge transformation. This was part of the regime's push towards Italianizing what was a fairly new and young country, but it was a very regionalized country. You know, previously it had been various city-states, various smaller constructs that were united in the late 19th century to become Italy. But obviously, a lot of the feelings of that, the way people felt about the country, wasn't really that strong, given everyone was still in their own sort of city areas and feeling more linked to their own location rather than to their country. So they hooked on to using football because of its increasing popularity as a means of promoting the uniting of the country. So as part of this, the fascist state took over football, basically took over the political running of it. But as part of that, they also created the National League, which what has become Serie A now is called something else back then. But that giving the most popular pastime in the country a national identity, making it Italian as opposed to disparate local leagues, and then joining with a sort of national final at the end. They also built various stadiums to house some of these clubs. They also influenced the clubs as well in terms of creating, if you like, some new super clubs that were merged from various smaller ones, mainly to sort of provide a higher standard. So within each city, provide one focal point or perhaps two to make them the big thing in the city and make it a much bigger deal. It's partly to raise the standard because they also wanted to improve the physical and mental well-being of their people. At the very top of that was the sporting elite and the athletes, and they wanted them to get better and better so that they could promote Italy internationally by performing better elsewhere. So at the bottom of that scale, they wanted greater focus on the physical and mental well-being of their people, which was, again, that's a similarity with Nazi Germany in terms of physical strength. Partly, of course, that is for mobilisation reasons, but there was a less that the health wasn't so good following World War One, and then there was a flu epidemic not so long after, and obviously the nation was in need of a bit more physicality and a bit more strength, and sport kind of came off that. The more physical population obviously led to the sporting cream rising to the top, so the standards of Italian football duly rose. There was a few other influences as well, foreign players coming in at times and so on, but the cream rose to the top, and they got at the end of it two World Cup triumphs and an Olympic gold medal, which came in Berlin 1936, coincidentally. As we've already noted, they also organised the 1934 World Cup, so the fascist state held for them the propaganda tournament, as we've mentioned, on similar lines to the Berlin Olympics. 1938 World Cup was rather more symbolic, I think. We mentioned a little bit about the need to win, but in terms of the symbolism with fascism reaching its peak and the war imminent, there was a lot of protests from anti-fascists. There was a lot of symbolism around the Italian team then, as Mussolini and the state wanted to promote themselves internationally in slightly more aggressive ways. But fascism deliberately associated itself with the success of that era, hugely so, in both in terms of club and international teams competing abroad, so much so that those teams were increasingly viewed as direct representatives of the regime rather than merely teams competing for themselves. So therefore, they were exposed to these increasing protests, and the 1938 World Cup was where that reached its peak. But overall, regardless of how these World Cup wins came about and the people involved, those first two World Cup victories for Italy were most definitely won under the fascist flag. They were won in the name of the fascist state, and frankly, they wouldn't have happened without the fascist state in various ways of influencing it. It just simply wouldn't have been possible without.
Yeah. It just, what you're saying there, do you think it would be fair to say that Italian football, I don't mean Italian football as a national team, the rise to prominence was very much a political construct then?
Most definitely. In terms of that degree of success, without doubt, the league is a fascist construct. Some of the clubs are a fascist construct. Many of the stadiums are a fascist construct. Without all of those and some of the other political issues in terms of players coming from abroad and the increase in standards at home, all of that would not have happened without the fascist state. And I don't want to sound like I'm bigging it up in any way, because obviously...
No. I mean,
but in terms of football, it most definitely had that influence in pushing Italy towards success.
Right. Steph?
I mean, like I say, I love this. I absolutely love it in terms of listening and learning, but... You've talked about the fascist state there, Aidan, and how they were the driving force behind you know, the development of Italian football, certainly in its domestic provision and at international level as well. But as a person, Mussolini himself, was he, how engaged was he with, I suppose, predominantly with football, as that's what we're talking about, but I suppose with sport in general, or did he just see it as a product?
From what I can glean from the various things I've read, he wasn't massively into it himself, other than seeing it as a means to an end. There's various clubs that have had fascist links through the years. There's various clubs that he may have more closely associated himself with during this era, but I've not really read any particular evidence that he was that big into it, if you like, other than wanting to associate himself with it because it was so incredibly popular and increasingly more and more so throughout the fascist era as the standards rose, that he just wanted to be seen with a good thing, if you like, and it was a good way of making himself man of the people. And even we'll come up with the 34 tournament in more detail, but one of the things that he did in the very first game for Italy there was he queued up outside to buy his tickets for him and his son, just like the man in the street had to. And this was a way of using it to make himself one of the masses, if you like, to show he was not above them or better than them, even though he obviously went and sat in the VIP box and all of that. But from what I can see and what I've read, it's as much as he may have enjoyed it far more than, say, Hitler did with sport in Germany, who very much wasn't into it. I think he saw it far more as a means to an end, particularly in football, because it was so popular. Other sports, but the whole push towards more physicality and more health and physical well-being in the country, that obviously improved Italy across the board. Other sports too, like Olympic performances improved in a whole host of sports. But again, I think it's more just the glory that he could get through that was what he was. It was what was his driving force.
It's pretty. Some things never change, do they? I think that's still replicated even today in most nations.
Yeah, definitely. Just look at Russia and the Winter Olympics and so on. It's very similar.
Yeah.
At this stage, we normally sort of ask is it a political and financial issue, a political or personal, or is it political and nationalistic? But I think the answer is pretty clear on this one as to what the driving force was behind the process, Aidan.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's plenty there. I mean, there is very little in the whole history of this period where the politics don't have a massive influence on it.
Yeah. So what was, you mentioned about how Mussolini sort of prioritised football and developed the game within the country. So what was the situation of football before that time? And you mentioned about city-states and regions within the country. So I take it from that the leagues were more regionalised before we centralised into a unitary organisation.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, primarily the Northern League was where the power was, as it is now in Italy. Of course, you've got Turin and Milan, the big industrial, as they were, powers at the time. This created the big clubs, which are the same ones we see now, that were powerful. The Northern League, therefore, was where all the strength lay. The rest of the country kind of lagged massively behind, but so did other areas away from Milan and Turin. When it all merged, well, at the state prior to the setup of the National League, there were various leagues throughout the country, and in the end, the system was you ended up with a northern winner and a southern winner, and they had a playoff, and that was basically the only time, once a year, where north played against south, and generally north won, but not always. But it wasn't a very national thing. Italian sport in general was far weaker before this era for various reasons. And we've talked, of course, about how they wanted to promote the physical well-being of the people in general, and that through that sport improved, the standards of sport improved. So by the late 1920s, once the fascists had taken over football, as well as various other sports, the Italian national football team was improving and had become one of the best in Europe by that time. In the late 20s, they had a big 4-3 win over Hungary. Mussolini was jumping on the bandwagon, praising the team for their perfect organisation, as he put it, which, of course, was a nice fascist trait to have. He gave everybody a signed photo of himself, which was nice. Which was a nice early indication of how Mussolini always wanted to personally associate himself with the team's success. So not just Italy or the regime, it was personal. And their first major achievement as a national team was a semi-final appearance at the 1928 Olympics. They narrowly lost that to Uruguay, who are obviously on their way to gold and having their own dominating era, one of the best teams of that decade, of course. But that gave notice that Italy were a growing force. Not many internationally had expected them to be able to compete with Uruguay at that time. Uruguay had won the 24 Olympics as well, of course. So only just losing out and then winning the bronze medal was quite an achievement. That kind of served notice that they were going in the right direction. Other sports too did quite well in the 28 games, but Mussolini, of course, demanded much more. So preparations for the 1932 Olympics across the board were much more thorough. At this time, athletes basically became state concerns, and this included the footballers, of course. The clubs in this time, there were various smaller European competitions. The Mitropa Cup was a competition for various central European clubs. It was probably the biggest club tournament around at the time. The powers of Austria and Hungary and Czechoslovakia and so on were the prominent teams of the era. Bologna and Juventus both performed well in that era in the Mitropa Cup, and the national team did well in the international into the national team equivalent, which is the Coppa d'Europa, performing quite well there, up to the same standards as some of those other nations and winning it on occasion. So it was prior to the 1934 tournament, Italy was certainly a team on the rise. It was definitely heading in the right direction. So reaching the peak in that era was no fluke.
No, indeed. We sort of looked around the sort of environment at the time. So let's jump into the tournament itself. Let's talk a little bit about the way the games went on, any influence that the regime may have had on the outcomes of games, and perhaps the propaganda around that.
Yes, I mean, you can go back. The story of it really begins in the 1930 tournament. So they bid to host that, in fact, but lost out to Uruguay. In a fairly typically flamboyant fascist gesture, Mussolini then took the hump at this and refused, having been refused the honour of visiting, he refused to send a team to Uruguay. There was, you know, they can cite costs and all of that as well, but there's definitely reports of him having taken the hump and withdrawing on a whim, but at the time he was already planning his own celebration for 4 years' time. So this was to be his Berlin Olympics. Of course, it was an ideal opportunity to show the world the achievements of fascism and place Italy on the world stage and international prestige and all that kind of thing, as well as giving the chance to continue the drive to unite the nation through sport and football in particular. There were, of course, you'd be unsurprised to learn, various rumours of murkiness in the bidding process for the 1934 tournament. There was tales
of... Can't believe it. That has never happened.
Are we talking about now or in the 1930s? Who knows?
All things at the same time.
There was tales of illegal payments, intimidation from members of his government, as well as from the Italian FA, which by that stage was effectively the fascist government as well. What sealed the deal to win them the tournament was the promise of from the Italian football chief to FIFA that if Italy hosted the tournament, any financial losses would be covered by the state. Again, that sounds very similar to nowadays. So they duly awarded Italy the tournament ahead of Sweden, who were the only other real contenders. FIFA, of course, even then weren't shy to award their showpiece based on profit. Rome was also given the honour of hosting the International Congress during the tournament, which, again, for Mussolini, was another feather of respectability in his cap. The regime, as the tournament got closer, they went through a huge publicity campaign around it. So it was all driven by a man called Achilles Darachi. Apologies for my pronunciation there, it's no doubt awful. But he was effectively the high priest of the cult of Il Duce, if you like. He was the main man behind the man. He's also the person who introduced the fascist salute. He was behind what had previously been the takeover, in effect, of the Italian game, which was the Carta di Viareggio, which outlawed foreign players, as well as taking over the political aspects and bringing in the Roman fascist salute, or the old-style Roman, but the now fascist salute. He was the man behind all of this. But in terms of the 1934 World Cup, he made sure that match tickets were printed on good quality paper with a glorious design to make them popular souvenirs. There was competition to design promotional posters. And the poster that won had a goal, a black ball, and the fascis, which is the symbol that gives fascism its name, although in and of itself it's not exclusively a fascist symbol. But it was obviously closely associated with this regime. There was also commemorative stamps with images of all the stadia, but also with an aeroplane flying on them, and that was essentially linking two forms of fascist achievement on the stamp. So even in little things like that, they were the propaganda and the promoting themselves ahead of and during the tournament. There was a new cigarette brand called World Championship during the tournament. All of this was designed to bombard the Italian population daily with World Cup and fascist iconography, just to make sure it was all rammed home and everyone was singing from the same hymn sheet, if you like. Just before I get on to the games, which I will get to in a sec, sorry, there was another thing also to note, is that Mussolini commissioned a huge trophy to go alongside the World Cup. So this was called Coppa del Duce, of course, named after himself. It was about six times larger than the Jules Rimet trophy. Had a group of footballers in an action scene right in front of another fascist symbol. This was the prominent trophy in any pictures you see of this tournament, of the presentations or the draw. This is the cup that you see rather than the Jules Rimet trophy, just making sure they took centre stage. So the draw for the tournament itself had the Coppa del Duce as the focal point, and that trophy was flanked by a squad of armed black shirts, just to make sure that you got the message that everything was going their way. In terms of the actual games themselves, one thing to note is that Italy actually had to qualify for this tournament, which in terms of hosts is pretty much a one-off, I think. But again, there's a bit of murkiness around this. There was a two-leg clash with Greece they had to come through, and they won the opening leg 4-0 in Milan, which was fair enough. They were clearly a better team, one of the strongest around. But the return match never took place. Now, Greece withdrew just beforehand, officially due to, you know, expecting to get beaten. They lost heart, didn't really see the point. But the other version of the story is that they were pressured into withdrawing by the Mussolini regime, and the financial loss of the second match not going ahead was compensated to them by the Italian FA, who allegedly purchased a house in Athens and gifted it to the Greek FA for its headquarters. So even 4-0 up, they allegedly weren't taking any chances. So the regime very much demanded victory. There was no way Italy could miss out on their show. But once they were there, the influence got stronger in terms of the actual games. I've already mentioned that their opening match that Mussolini queued up for, which was against the United States. Now, this was a nice routine 7-1 hammering. USA were actually semi-finalists of the previous tournament, so it's not as though they were complete no-hopers, but Italy actually made short measure of them. So then we get to the quarter-final with Spain. Now, this is where the real controversy starts. Now, this was played in Florence, which is one of the stadiums that the fascist regime had themselves built to show their abilities off to the world. And it became infamous for its indiscipline and violence throughout the game. A number of players on both sides were forced off with injury. One Italian player, Pizziolo, suffered a broken leg. But the game ended 1-1, so they had to play again the next day, which didn't give much chance for recovery when it's the very next day. Both teams, of course, had to make a huge number of changes, and one of the most significant was Spain's goalkeeper and captain, who'd been injured in the first match. Now, the stories about this game don't elaborate fully on in terms of the rough housing going on, but most seem to agree on the fact that Spain's goalkeeper was rather physically dealt with by some one or two Italian forwards. But of course, the referee was very much lenient towards the Italians. So there was several records of favourable decisions going Italy's way. In the replay, which Italy ended up winning 1-0 with the goal from Giuseppe Meazza, of course, of Milan Stadium fame. There was Spain probably should have had a penalty 5 minutes from the start. They also had two goals disallowed, one for a rather questionable offside, and the other one so that the referee could pull play back and award a free kick to Spain, bizarrely. This was all, should be noted, under the watchful eye of Mussolini in the stadium, nodding along approvingly, of course. But Italy were through with that 1-0 victory and into the semi-finals against Austria. Now, this is... I know you've written about this team yourself, Gary, the Austrian Wunder team at this time were one of the strongest in Europe, Matthias Sindelar being their star man, but he was quite lightweight, and against Italy's physicality he was suffering a bit. So Italy keeping it most definitely on the physical side was the best way for them to approach it. But the real story of this game is that it's been long rumoured that Mussolini himself had dinner with the Swedish referee, a man called Ivan Eklund, the day before. Some of the tales put it very much in italics that they were there to discuss tactics, but who knows what they actually discussed. There's no real evidence, of course, of this meeting, but there are so many stories about it that you're inclined to think there's something in it anyway. The stories always claim to be backed up by two very controversial moments in the match itself. So the only goal came from a guy called Enrique Gaeta, who was one of the Oriundi, one of the Argentinian-born players in Italy's team. Several reports claim this was an offside goal, and also that the Austrian goalkeeper was pushed during the build-up quite blatantly, but the referee turned a blind eye to that. More bizarrely, later on, there were several reports of the referee intercepting an Austrian pass himself to head the ball to an Italian. Now, of course, we don't have YouTube from this tournament. I have no proof either way whether that actually happened or not, but it's definitely something that I've read about in various places, but sadly can't confirm, and it could be that events have been exaggerated somewhat. You'd like to think not, because it sounds great, but there you go. Equally, the other semi-final was between Czechoslovakia and Germany, and even this had a source of controversy, a fair degree of alleged influence from the fascist regime, because the referee was an Italian, which again was slightly bizarre since Italy were the final opponents in waiting, and he supposedly made a number of questionable decisions in favour of the Czechs, primarily because they were thought likely to provide far weaker opposition to Italy in the final. By this stage, of course, the media were stoking a huge growing sense of national pride and confidence and superiority, and in a hugely triumphant tone, of course, as is the fascist way, and the team's successes were sort of stirring the nation behind them and so on. So on to the final against the Czechs again. A number of areas of political intrigue here. On the day of the final itself, much to Mussolini's chagrin, Czechoslovakia decided that day was the day to make it official they would be allied with the Soviet Union. Now, this communist pact was very much seen as an anti-fascist move, and to announce it on the day of the final was seen by Mussolini, and probably correctly, as a hugely symbolic gesture about the two political philosophies. So, of course, many communists within Italy had been suffering hugely under the fascist regime. So, to many of them, the final was basically viewed as mirroring that struggle between the forces of communism and fascism. So for that announcement to come that day was rather controversial. Il Duce himself, Mussolini, was in the stadium, of course, as were all the higher-ranking officials of the fascist party. There were representatives of Nazi Germany there and the communist Czechs. Mussolini himself had apparently given the team a pep talk the night before. The story I read about that said it was re-emphasising the need to win. Quite what terms he put that in, I don't know. We can only speculate, but I'm sure the emphasising was rather strong. The final was played in the Fascist Party Stadium, the PNF Stadium in Rome. with the press, the Italian press anyway, were gushingly reporting on it, on how Mussolini's arrival into the stadium caused the fans to completely forget they were there for a sporting contest, and it was a staggering display of passion towards him. But this passion continued when the teams entered the stadium, handkerchiefs being waved, and supposedly, according to the Italian press anyway, shouts of Duce, Duce, all to the backdrop of the military band playing fascist hymns. So, I mean, if you can picture the scene, it's rather more like a fascist rally than a World Cup final, but that's most definitely the way that was all set up. The referee for the final was, again, our old friend Ivan Eklund from Sweden. Surprisingly enough, the man who'd taken charge of the semi-final with Austria and got his own assist. Again, the suspicions surrounding this, of course, because he'd been invited to the fascist VIP box just prior to kickoff. The meal he had before the semi-final with Mussolini obviously wasn't quite enough. They needed to make sure he'd really got the message. Now, Italy did win, of course, 2-1 after extra time. Now, they had actually gone behind, and their equaliser was very late on. So it nearly didn't go their way, but in the end, of course, it did. There was a huge ceremony after the game, and the fascist anthem, Giovinezza, was played, and the team were presented primarily with the Coppa del Duce, but also with the Jules Rimet Trophy. Very much like the story we had of a game earlier, each player got a signed photo of Mussolini. They got a gold medal for recognition of everything they'd done for conquering the world of football in the name of Mussolini, as he would like to say. The Italian press obviously went to town, and they exploited this victory to full potential. Any positive praise they got for their organisation of the tournament or for their team from abroad was reprinted in full in Italian press. But everything they wrote was all, of course, set in the imagery and language of the national struggle and football patriotism. And it was all about the sort of merits of collective organisation and the discipline and how all of this had been derived from Mussolini's inspiration, thinking everything back to him. Now, this confirmed this emergence of this generation that was to dominate international football for much of the rest of the decade. But the flip side of that, though, was that Italian teams now had to play under the burden of being expected to dominate. And Mussolini himself became a bit frustrated, as I sort of touched on earlier, that Italy were perceived, in some quarters anyway, as only being world champions because of the corruption and bribery. And therefore, to Mussolini, retaining the cup in 1938 suddenly now became vitally important if they were to truly be regarded as the best. And just one final political afternote to the 1934 tournament would be, just 4 days after that final, there was a historic meeting in Venice between Hitler and Mussolini, and that was actually the first time the two of them ever met face to face. And it was, of course, the beginning of the Axis, that would be the power base in Europe, and set Europe on course for the deadly events to come a few years later.
Yeah, Stu.
Wow. I think, Aidan, as you were talking through this, and to be fair, just before you went into the tunnel, I'm quite interested to know, and you might not be able to answer, I don't know, but quite how FIFA felt about the unfolding of all of this. So, you know, the unfolding of a fascist regime hosting their tournament. Now, I know you talk about alleged bribery and, you know, it sort of being maybe not quite as FIFA likes to operate, in terms of maybe not the most clear of bidding procedures, if you like. But in terms of, obviously, you know, this, even just the awarding of an alternative trophy. I mean, were FIFA at that time so, not lame, but so in the shadow of this regime and, you know, within Mussolini, that actually they were almost an insignificant organisation within their own tournament?
I think that's probably fair to say. I mean, it's all very new, of course, at this time, and it's only a few years before that it was the Olympic Games that was the big thing for football, as much as it was for all these other sports. So FIFA organising their own tournament, it was very much in its infancy, well, obviously only being the second tournament. But in terms of FIFA's own power and sway over it all, I don't think, as you say, it wasn't fully in control, and presumably faced with somebody of his charisma and power and influence, as well as the fact that they'd promised to underwrite all the money and so on, so they probably didn't want to irritate him either for financial reasons. I suspect they were fairly powerless to do anything to stop him. In the most favourable light to himself and off the pitch.
Colonising of the Italian team and sort of eliminating foreigners from playing in Italy. But conversely, the Italian triumph was built on a slightly different foundation, because you mentioned the Oriundi earlier, where players from South America were taken into Italy to strengthen the team. I sort of found about this when I was writing a piece about Lucas Monti, who is the only player to play in consecutive World Cup finals for two different countries. And he also said that with his daughter, his granddaughter said that he had told her that in both World Cup finals, he had been threatened with received a death threat at half time. Firstly, when he was playing for Argentina and Uruguay, and if he didn't lose, he would be killed. And at half time in the 1930s, he was in the Italian team, that if he didn't win, he would be killed.
So, at least he got it right both times.
Both times. So, I mean, and come the end of the day, who could damn well blame him? But so obviously there was a sort of a desire to almost strengthen the Italian cause. I wouldn't say by almost any means, but turning a blind eye to things that perhaps weren't exactly pucker was. Just touch on the club issues, because there was talk that Mussolini was lent towards Lazio, but when he brought a lot of players over, they went up to the north, and particularly to Juve. I think Monti went to Juve.
Yes.
So did he have club alignments, or was the import of players just solely to advance the Italian Cup, the Azzurri?
It was twofold. It was to advance the national team, but it was also to generally raise standards. Now, the sort of the infancy of this goes back to the way I was mentioning earlier about how the general sporting or physical well-being of the nation was one of the main focuses of the fascist regime through the 1920s. But this, oddly, had given the Italian powers the slightly misguided notion that they no longer needed foreign players or foreign influence, so because they thought they were developing strongly enough themselves. Excuse me. So there was a ban on foreign players put in, which was in that Carta di Viareggio, the fascist blueprint for the game. So that meant no foreign players or coaches could come into Italy at all. But that soon became one of the more unpopular aspects of the charter, for both the clubs and the regime, actually, as they both realised what they were missing out on to some extent. Culturally, there'd been an awful lot of emigration from Italy in the 19th and early 20th centuries, predominantly to South America. There was an estimated 5 or 6 million Italians living abroad by this time. So there was no shortage of high-class footballers with Italian roots playing in South America, where the game had a much stronger history than it did in Italy. It was much more powerful. Of course, you mentioned Argentina and Uruguay, even long before that first World Cup final, that they were two of the stronger teams outside Britain, if you like. But this recruitment was, of course, outlawed by the Carta di Viareggio. But not wanting to miss out on the potential to improve the Italian team and the Italian league at this time, and to exploit this source of talent. So rather than repeal that law, and various other things that would have to change as a result of that, they just overcame it by introducing joint citizenship, essentially making the sons of Italians born abroad Italian. They were just Italians who happened to live abroad. It was basically seen as fitting snugly into the narrative of the burgeoning Italian nationalism. You know, we aren't just separate city states. We are Italy, and these are the people they had to emigrate for. For various reasons, but they're Italian as well. We see them as just the same as us, if you like. So they're depicted as part of a colonization of the Americas rather than the actual economic truth, which was they were poor migrants driven away. But that didn't fit the fascist narrative, of course. They wanted to show them that they were just pioneers, if you like, who'd gone elsewhere but were still Italian. So the regime saw no contradiction at all in these men playing for Italy. If essentially the law now was that they never ceased to be Italian, they were just simply out of the country. So these sons of the first generation expatriate Italians, as we said, this is primarily Argentina and Uruguay, they were welcomed back, and they formed the backbone of the success of the teams and what the success of this era was based on. So there's definitely a bit of an irony there in terms of the fact that it was the rule on no foreigners that actually led to the introduction of the Oriundi, who then inspired Italy to World Cup glory. So yeah, if they hadn't been so insular in that way, they may never have got these foreigners who actually pushed them all away. Yeah, so yeah. As you've noted, these players, they immediately came into Serie A. And as you said, Gary, primarily to the big clubs in the north. Luis Monti went to Juventus, as did Raimondo Orsi. There was another who played in the 1934 World Cup. He was actually the first to make an impact in Italy. He signed for Juventus not long after the 1928 Olympics, where he'd been playing for Argentina. And Luis Monti, of course, came following the 1930 World Cup, where he played for Argentina there. In total, there was 47 players who came to Italy during this era from South America. Five of those ultimately played for the national team in the 1934 World Cup. But it's generally part of raising standards overall. Obviously, not all of those were just for the national team. Some of them came over considerably earlier than that 1934 World Cup. But they did raise standards in terms of their influence on the club teams, and obviously the very best in terms of their influence on the national team. This policy did draw some criticism, but Italy's coach Vittorio Pozzo, he has a famous quote where he sort of countered this by saying, if they can die for Italy, they can play for Italy. And that's a nod towards the conscription rules at the time, which also included those who were born overseas of Italian parentage. Basically, to the regime, blood was less important than a clear and general proof of their patriotism. And by coming back to Italy, they were deemed to be displaying that. It's also something to note that Oriundi isn't just a past phenomenon. Mauro Camoranesi, who was part of the 2006 Italian World Cup winning squad, he's an Argentine of an Italian father. So the exact same thing is still happening in the 21st century, although obviously the rules are somewhat different now. But some people, of course, this dual nationality of the Oriundi was a dilution of the Italian success. However, because of the rather physical nature of their play, and especially Monti, this was pitched as being thanks to their Italian roots. This is the way it was all portrayed by the regime through the press. So they were then thought of and portrayed as having displayed the key characteristics and true aspects of a real Italian footballer, because they were so physical. But they also played a fundamental role in not just increasing general standards, but also the tactical development of the Italian game. So at this time, Argentina and Uruguay, as I've said, were quite considerably in advance of Italy in terms of their footballing development. So the tactical innovations and changes of style that they brought with them from South America definitely pushed Italy further on and helped them climb the ladder towards the glory that came. So it's fairly clear, all in all, that without these Oriundi, Italy would never have reached the level that they did in the 1930s.
Stu? I'm quite interested in, I can understand this concept from the perspective of the fascist regime. I can understand it from the perspective of raising standards across Italian football, and I can certainly understand it in terms of them playing in club football and supporters getting behind it. I think where I'm asking you in terms of conflict is, if you're saying that there was, you said there was five players played in the 34 World Cup. Now, how did the Italian national players who maybe had to make way for these players, was there any conflict within camp? Was there any, bad feeling, or was it? I'll say, publicly, bad feeling wouldn't be allowed, I assume, because it was for the best and for the collective. But I just wonder if there's any evidence, any stories anywhere, or any written evidence where players actually, Italian players, sort of born in Italy and were playing for the national team who had to make way for these players, whether there was any conflict there.
Privately, I'm sure what you're saying is true in terms of some of the players. I haven't seen any evidence of this. All the sort of evidence I've read about the squad and the camps that they had is that it was massively militaristic. And therefore, because of that, I can't imagine that there would be any room for any dissent of any kind. Pozzo himself, the coach, was very much a strong leader. He was a military man himself in the past. And aside from the whole fascist influence on proceedings, it was a militaristic setup anyway. As such, it seems quite unlikely that any dissension would have been tolerated at all. So I imagine those who actually made it way to the World Cup squad, who were born and bred Italians, were fully on board, otherwise they wouldn't have been there.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
you mentioned earlier, Aidan, about Vittorio Pozzo, because obviously he was the manager of the, whatever you want to call it, those days of the both 34 and 38. Obviously, when you're winning, you're okay, you know, especially when you're sort of winning under a fascist regime. But I just wonder what sort of situation may have accrued if the Italians had lost, particularly in Italy, or you know, or had failed to retain their title 4 years later in France. And perhaps we can touch on France after that.
Yeah. Again, it's another intriguing question, isn't it, of what would have happened to these people if it had gone a different way? Historically, he's become very much a fascist regime, and whether this is fair or not is a big question. I think that's a whole subject in itself, I think, because there's evidence either way from what I can gather. Like I said, he was very militaristic, so his approach was in keeping, if you like, with the fascist style, I guess, of very controlling and everyone being very much on message and for the good of the collective. Equally, there's various other bits of evidence of him, especially later in life anyway, things came out of evidence of him being involved in various anti-fascist resistance movements and supplying food to partisan rebels and assisting escape of prisoners during the war and things like this, which makes you question of whether he really was as closely associated as it sounded. There's some things we've come on to in the 38 World Cup that suggest the other way, that he was very much shouting for the regime, if you like. But it's hard to say what would have happened if they hadn't won. I suspect because of the great will he'd earned from the 1934 that had the 38 one gone wrong, I don't think anything would have necessarily gone too badly for him. But in times like that, you do wonder that there might have been bad news for various people had things not gone well. There were some comments in the 38 Olympics that were attributed to Mussolini as a sort of threat. We'll come on to them in more detail in a sec. But there's things like that that, without sort of delving into the deeper meaning of some of these things, they can be interpreted as an outright threat, similar to, you know, people have said about the North Koreans after the 2010 World Cup and what on earth happened to them and how many of them get sent off to the hard labour camps. But whether that's really true or not, we just don't know. And in terms of Pozzo, it's hard to say, but I think some of what was perceived as a threat might actually have not been quite as bad as that.
Yeah, yeah. It's all interpretation, I suppose. But again, if somebody says, you know, it's win or die, and whether that could be interpreted as win or bust or whatever,
exactly.
You know, you're not going to be too light-hearted about it, I suppose, are you?
it's funny. I mean, you know, for me, like, you know, you've talked about this playing under extreme pressure. I mean, you know, there's playing on the big stage and the big occasion, but when you have this inference of playing for your livelihood or your life, now whether you're an opponent or a referee or an Italian footballer, or, you know, the Italian manager at the time, you know, there is always this inference, and I think it a lot of it reminds me of the 78 World Cup and the dictatorship in Argentina and sort of what went on there. And it seems to me that, I mean, and, you know, the Olympics is, you know, can also be a target for this, but it seems to me that football, you know, and in particular the World Cup, just seems to have always attracted I suppose, political dominance or political influence. And it never seemed, you know, we've got the World Cup, you know, we've had the World Cup in Russia, we've got the World Cup coming in Qatar. And for me, football and the World Cup and FIFA as well, I suppose, you know, we're talking about their influence. It never seems to actually quite be able to escape the dominance either of a host nation or the regime that was within a nation. And it's, we don't seem to learn the lessons, I suppose, from history is what I'm saying there.
Yeah, I think Russia and Qatar, the last one and the next one, it's very much going to be of that ilk, isn't it? Of it's about portraying the strength of your nation or the wealth of your nation and what you can achieve. And yeah, nothing changes, does it? It's all exactly the same.
It is. Nothing. And which is why I asked the question about FIFA and their influence. And, you know, and you were right, Aidan, it was very much in its embryonic stages. I mean, now FIFA is incredibly powerful, and yet it still seems to not turn a blind... Yeah, it does turn a blind eye. FIFA can come and sue me if they want. But it's, you know, it seems to still be at the mercy, if you like, of these nations and of the rulers of these nations.
Yeah, exactly. This is, comes back to the question you'll ask at the very end, Gary, and you have done all these episodes, is that can football sit independently, or is it inevitable? And, you know, we're already answering that in some ways here, aren't we? That the influence of the host nation in particular is always going to be the sort of, not even just a backdrop at times, sometimes it's going to be full front and centre of what's going on in the tournament and how it's viewed. And there's no real getting away from that, I don't think.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, our great enemy on these podcasts, you know, and Stu and I have mentioned this so many times, is time. You know, we've got so many things we want to discuss. So, but before we move on to other questions, I wonder if you can just briefly touch on the 1938 World Cup and Italy's defence of their success. Perhaps give us a little bit of political context around that.
Yeah, so as I mentioned earlier, it's a bit more about the symbolism this time with the war imminent. They'd also cut off the back of the 34 World Cup, they'd gone to the 36 Olympics and won the gold medal there. Now, this was all with amateur players, of course, so it's a different set of people as from the 34 one, but that was another feather in their cap, if you like. But the 38 World Cup was definitely the peak of their sporting achievement, because it was achieved without the rumours of you know, home advantage and all that came with that. I mentioned earlier there was a lot of anti-fascist protest during this tournament. Now, as well as the various protests from the French, because Mussolini had made all sorts of anti-French or pro-Franco statements as well just prior to the tournament. So there was all sorts of anti-fascist protests from the French, but equally there was a huge number of Italian political exiles who obviously chose this moment to make themselves heard and turn up to the games and do their own protests. So wherever Italy went in this tournament, they were followed by massive anti-fascist protests. So this really hit them in the first game, which was in Marseille against Norway. And this is a team that they really ought to have beaten quite comfortably, but it ended up going into extra time. They managed to get through, but there was an estimated 10,000 Italian political exiles in the crowd that day. Now, these are people who fled the regime for fear of persecution. So obviously they had a lot to say on that issue in that game, and they made themselves very well heard. The Roman salute in that game, which was something that the Carta di Viareggio had basically ruled the Italian team must do before every game. So they had to do this before the game, like it or not. But however it came about, they had to do it. But Pozzo actually made the players perform it twice on this occasion because of the huge abuse and barrage of whistles and jeers and so on that were raining down on them when they did it the first time. He ordered them to sort of hold it and keep it up until the noise quietened down. Then they put their arms down and he said, right, do it again now. And it was essentially him demonstrating they had no fear and that they were ready to face up to the challenge. But this, of course, could be taken another way as evidence of Pozzo supporting the regime and so on, despite his attempts otherwise. But anyway, they made it through that game to a quarter final with the hosts in France. Now, this is where there's more symbolism again. Now, Italy and France obviously both wear blue, so somebody had to change. They couldn't both wear blue on the day, and they drew lots for this, and Italy lost. Now, instead of their normal white chain shirt, which is what they wore usually, their team were ordered to play in all black. Now, this decision was generally thought to come directly from Mussolini, partly through the annoyance at how his team had been received in that first match and the reception they'd received, but there's no real evidence either way. But what we can say is that the black shirt, or the maglia nera, as it was called in Italy, this is obviously the black shirts is the fascist heavies, if you like, and that appeared in a full international before. The Olympic team had actually won it in Berlin, but it had never been used in a full international. But not only was it all black, it also had a very prominent Fascio Littoria symbol on it, therefore making the direct link in everybody's face between the team and the regime they represented. Essentially, it was a symbolic two fingers up to all the anti-fascist protesters. They did win through, and they also then beat Brazil in the semi-finals with various more protests as a backdrop. And then they faced Hungary in the final, and this is where the quote you mentioned just before, Gary, the win or die, vincere o morire. Now, win or die is the literal translation of that, and this is the message, the telegram that Mussolini sent to the team the night before the match. Now, I think there's two ways of looking at this. One is that while that literal translation isn't quite what the message intends, it isn't a huge leap to think that a person known for purging people who didn't believe in his ideologies may have some more sinister motive behind this message. But equally, on the other hand, the literal translation isn't quite what this expression means. And as you say, it's more like win or bust as an encouragement rather than a deadly threat. It's impossible for us to say exactly how was intended, of course, but this message most definitely did get sent, and it's win or die was the translation that got taken. So much so that after Italy won it, they beat Hungary 4-2 in the final. The Hungarian goalie, a guy named Antal Szabo, he was quoted after as saying, well, he may have let in four goals, but at least he saved their lives. So even the Hungarians knew about this message. It got out that this win or die was most definitely the instruction the Italians were under. And it was clearly, certainly widely rumoured at the time. So this second win, it was very much hugely important for the fascist regime, given of the 34th tournament. Essentially, they needed those rumours put right. They needed to win on the field. And in this case, it was very much against the odds because of all the protests that came about. All the players, again, they got another gold medal, they got another photo, they got Mussolini and all of that back in Rome. Although, oddly enough, for somebody of his megalomania, he didn't actually pick up the World Cup trophy himself, which I don't know if I'd have been able to resist if I'd been there, but there you go, he managed not to. And, of course, fascism had its eye on another trophy in 1942, but things went a bit different for that. But Italy's, for all of their unquestionable talent and success in that era, the political gestures of the black shirts and that double Roman salute in that first game, that kind of encapsulated the Italian football's rise under fascism and obviously clearly significant political gestures in that tournament.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, as I said, you know, time sort of against. I'm going to jam some more questions in before we let you go. Do you want to fire first, Tim?
Yeah. I mean, winning a World Cup is extremely difficult. It's in your home. If it's in your home country, there is that advantage. To defend it, you know, is even more difficult. But do you think this Italian side, this era, like you say, you know, a gold medal, which obviously amateur players are slightly different, but do you think either that they will never get the credit that they deserve for what they achieved, or that they don't actually deserve the credit for what they achieved? You know, I'm asking your opinion, I suppose, on that one.
Yeah, there'll always be something of an asterisk against them, I mean, 34 in particular, but both were obviously inextricably linked with the regime. But, I mean, I think my opinion is really that the on-field achievements were what they were. Italy were one of the best teams in the world at the time. Now, there are some other factors, of course. Not everybody was there. The British teams didn't go there was a lack of South American opposition in 34, and I think only Brazil in 38. Austria had disappeared by 1938 when they were contenders to win. Spain couldn't go because they're in the middle of civil war. Things like that give a little bit of a question mark over them, but you know, you can only beat what's in front of you. And Italy were, without doubt, prior to these, one of the best at the time anyway. It's hard to say that they wouldn't have won, regardless of what happened, that they deserved the victories. But there will be a little bit of an asterisk against 1934 in particular. Although that, of course, like we talk about Argentina in 78, none of it is ever proven in terms of any of the influence. It's all just rumour, hearsay, no matter how strong those rumours are. They also proved themselves to be quite a strong team. You know, they played England not long after the 1934 World Cup. This was went down as a famous the Battle of Highbury. They were playing with 10 men for only 80 minutes. They were 3-0 down and fought back to 3-2 and nearly equalised. That was a shot in the arm to the English that went unheeded. You know, it was another couple of decades before England really got the message that European teams were really up at the same level. Or beyond them. So that showed that Italy were really one of the strongest teams. So it's, you know, I think in terms of sporting achievement, they were one of the best and therefore deserved it. But it's always going to be inextricably linked to the fascist regime, not just wearing it and performing it, but also it was achieved through the changes that the regime itself instigated. It simply wouldn't have happened without that influence from the fascists. Now, that's not to denigrate it as a sporting achievement, because obviously improving standards and training better and more physical development and so on, that's all, you know, fascists aren't the only one to have done that, of course. But it's still, the fact remains that it was because of the fascist regime that all of that happened. So there's definitely something of a black mark, but as a sporting achievement, I still think it was worthy.
Okay, good answer.
So, Hayden, given home advantage is a massive thing, you know, as you mentioned earlier, and you know, it's easy for us to jump on a pedestal and, you know, criticise, you know, the Italians in 34 and Argentina under the military junta as well. You know, England weren't too bashful about you know, exploiting home advantage. You know, Jeff Hurst goal in the final that never crossed the line. And the game that was switched from Goodison Park, so England could keep playing at Wembley. Home advantage is a massive thing, you know. And you know, and because of that, do you think the 1938 triumph was perhaps more worthy than the 1934 one because they hadn't got the massive home advantage and all the propaganda and support that Mussolini was offering?
Yeah, to some extent it was. I mean, especially they were also more up against opposition in terms of off-the-field opposition, even if some of the on-the-field opposition was missing, that it's definitely less tainted, if you like, in terms of the sporting achievement, because there was no talk of any underhand influence or any murkiness from the fascist state, because they obviously had no control over the 1938 tournament. So you could certainly argue that it's slightly more legitimate because of that. That's not to say, though, that the 1934 win wasn't also a legitimate sporting achievement, because they were one of the best teams in the world at the time, regardless. Some of the influence may not have actually affected the results wholesale. You know, you can never argue that any decision here and there completely changes things. A paid-off referee may do, but that you know, there's no evidence either way of whether that's actually true or not. But there will always be a slightly bigger asterisk against 1934. 1938 had none of that, just heavy on symbolism, of course. So it, the big political influence on it is more symbolic and more what it represented, rather than any question about how deserving they were on the field. And I think 1938, they were most definitely deserving on the field. 1934, probably so, but there's that little asterisk against it.
Yeah, good point, Matt, good point. Stu?
I'm going to ask a question, and I feel like it might be quite controversial, but I don't mean it to. It like I say, it's, you know, your opinion, Aidan, that I'm after, but two World Cups and an Olympic gold medal in between. In terms of regime under which football can thrive, I'm not saying is fascism the way to go. I'm not saying that. I'm really not saying that. However, did Mussolini and his regime, you know, is it, I'm not saying is it a blueprint to follow, but is it, you know, did they get it right in terms of preparing a nation for dominance within a sport? Sorry.
Yeah, it's obviously a dicey subject, but one of the main books I read in research for this and in general for general knowledge and so on about this kind of era put it quite well, and I've noted it down to make sure I got to put this in. So thanks for this question. So this is good. The quote there was: "Fascism was good for Italian football, and football was good for fascism." So it was win-win for both. Without the fascist state behind it, Italian football would never have developed the way it did. It wouldn't have achieved what it did. It wouldn't have hit those heights. But equally, without football doing what it did, fascism wouldn't have been viewed the same way in Italy. It wouldn't have had the uniting influence it did. And it wouldn't have brought nation together, not entirely, of course, but to some extent behind the common cause, seeing that through the prism of sport, but also that, of course, is a metaphor for everything else in Italian society and uniting behind one common cause. So the politicising of the game, it did enhance the regime's international prestige and linked its nationalist values and so on. Football was, of course, it was used in this. It was used to develop this nationalistic identity, but they sort of made the most of this opportunity that football gave them to shape public opinion and infiltrate daily life. But without that, football wouldn't have achieved what it did. So the rise of both fascism and Italian football are so utterly linked that they both reached a peak to one manner or another in the same era. And that's no coincidence. It was all one influencing the other and vice versa. There was so much link through it all. So yeah, it is kind of a blueprint for development, but not one I would, you know, recommend.
Yeah, that's a good answer. Great answer. I'm sorry about the question, but I was interested in what you have to think.
It was a great question and you know, great answer. And, you know, I'm really chuffed you asked it because I've got sort of like a semi follow up to that. So, you know, I your reputation for impossible questions. Well, I'm going to try and launch one here. So, brace yourself, Aidan. Brace yourself. So where would Italian football be today if it wasn't for Mussolini?
Oof. What you wouldn't have, wouldn't have had in the same time frame, I guess, is the National League and some of the super clubs that we know about now. These things would obviously have followed. You know, a National League was inevitable sooner or later, but it was a fascist construct when it happened. There's various clubs that were and stadiums that were. So in terms of clubs, Fiorentina was an amalgamation of two smaller teams in Florence to generate the one big city team. AS Roma was exactly as well. It was a fascist construct to give the capital city a team that could portray the image and strength of the capital across the country and into Europe. So, you know, these things may well have happened in one way or another anyway, but they didn't happen through anything else. They actually happened through the fascist regime, and therefore, you know, lots of how things look today are due to what happened in that era. And they may look slightly different. They may look the same regardless, but we'll never fully know. But equally, the successes of Italians abroad being part of Italy, that, again, it's a very much a fascist construct. And therefore, those successes are so utterly linked to it as well. It's, yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating question, really, and yeah, it's an impossible one. So you're well done. You've done your mind that.
Get in.
But I think really, kind of coming back round to the start in my answer, I think many of these things would have happened anyway, but maybe they wouldn't have happened at that time and quite in that way. The league would have obviously happened regardless. Every country ended up with a national league, but maybe it would have looked slightly different and maybe some of these clubs would not have looked how they do. Fiorentina and Roma may not have existed. Stadiums in Florence and Bologna may not have existed at least in this way, they may have looked completely different. Some teams at the time had to change their names. You know, the Genoa, Inter and Milan, they all had anglicised names. They had to change them for a while, but they've changed back. So you would imagine that would have still been the same no matter what. But there's definitely no denying the heavy influence on some aspects of that. I think probably the biggest thing that you think might not have happened is specific clubs that may not have existed in that guise.
Yeah, great answer, mate. Great answer. That's Gary once, 273.
Brilliant.
Yes, Stu.
I suppose the last question then from me, Aidan. Obviously, all the things we've talked about, the success, everything. What is the perception of this era from contemporary Italian fans of football? Is it looked on with pride? Is it looked on with a little bit of, I suppose, trepidation or a little bit of, not resentment or anger, that's probably the wrong way, but is it sort of still celebrated and acknowledged, or is it more tried to be forgotten and dismissed a little bit? Obviously, 82 and 2006 have helped subsequently, but I'm just interested how current Italian fans perceive this era.
Yeah, I've been trying to sort of look into this in anticipation of this kind of question. I think that thing you said just at the end there about 82 and 2006, I hadn't necessarily thought of it like that, but that I think is crucial in that without those, they would have only had these two wins to fall back on, and maybe they would have been viewed as, you know, terrific achievements, solely terrific achievements without any asterisk against them whatsoever, if they'd been the only wins that Italy had had. But obviously, they've got four World Cup stars, but two of them are most definitely from this era. But what I can't find is any particular evidence that Italians don't view them as anything other than a sporting success and a sporting victory. And that's what they were at the end of the day. And the players themselves and club teams and so on at the time repeatedly emphasised that they weren't winning in the name of the regime as such, but of the country. They, of course, though, wore the insignia of the regime rather than just, say, the Italian flag like they do now. They performed the salute, but they would say that's just what Italians did, or at least had to do at that time. They weren't doing anything that the rest of the country didn't have to do too. So I think Italians now would be certainly delighted to claim four World Cup stars for their own. I don't think there's any particular view, at least I can't find any evidence, that the first two of those are particularly discredited in any way because of the links to fascism.
Okay, thank you.
And you sort of alluded to the closing question earlier, so you've obviously sort of cheated a little bit and thought ahead. So I'm not going to ask the question. Yeah, I am really. I'm going to ask the question. So always our closing questions are always the same. So given what you've said, and you might answer this in the context of the area we're talking about, or the modern era, or both, if you want to touch on both. So the question is this: can football exist in a political vacuum, or does the passion engendered by the game too easily lend itself to being a political tool? In short, is the political football inevitable?
Well, I do think it is inevitable for the host of reasons that we've already mentioned, but not always, of course, to the extent that a fascist regime takes it to. But as we mentioned, in terms of other countries and so on, the desire to promote a nation and project an image of strength and or even superiority to the watching world is one that will always cause some regimes in some countries, and obviously in Mussolini's case it certainly did, will always cause them to use that for their own gains. To me, it's the sheer popularity of football and its being embedded in popular culture, of so many countries around the world that makes it ideal for being used, unfortunately, as a political tool. The same would apply equally to the Olympic Games. You know, because it's so big and so powerful and so popular, it's just ripe for being used, unfortunately. In the case of the fascist era, it's easy to understand the means by which football could be used to develop an identity amongst the population, to Italianise the country, to bring it all together, and in terms of fascist ideology, in terms of the common strength and the collective nature of it all. But it's equally how success could be, international success could be seen to improve the standing of the country abroad. And obviously, in that kind of era where you know, things weren't as global and international as they are now, and portraying your country through a successful hosting of a competition and a successful team in that and other competitions will have had a massive impact and a massive bearing on how Italy was perceived abroad. Obviously, it goes too far, and it certainly did in when it comes to interference and so on. And the reason there is because the desire for victory has turned into a need for victory, and that's where it ends up too far, and that's where a fascist regime or other dictatorships in the likes of Argentina and or in Russia more recently, that's where things fall down. So more recently, you can still see this. We touched on it briefly, but look at the 2014 Winter Olympics in Sochi. I mean, that's a prominent example of the Russian state interfering, in this case with doping, to ensure the Russian athletes dominated. So this is, of course, to demonstrate their strength and superiority, all, of course, with the implicit approval or done for them by the regime. It's a slight variation, but it's the same story repeating as happened in Mussolini's time in the 1934 Olympics. So, World Cup, sorry. So, it's nothing new now, and it was nothing then that wouldn't go on and be repeated all sorts of times. So we see this happening time and again. And I mean, football, possibly now examples of, say, the Chinese Super League and the money going into that from the state as a way of partially improving standards, but also flexing their financial muscles, if you like, and demonstrating their power. And of course, the Qatar World Cup, which is an expression of the might of a country and the wealth of a country, and it's in particular of its power brokers through the prism of football, off the field at least anyway, is showing that it's still now a powerful political tool and it will still be used. And I think that purely comes down to its popularity. And unfortunately, there's not a lot we can do about that. That influence is always going to be there and it's always going to be used. Of course, influence on the matters on the field are hopefully less now than they were in Mussolini's time. But even that, you do question that some of those things may still be happening from gambling perspective and all that kind of stuff. And the influence is there. Maybe that's less political, but there are still the fact that football's popularity leaves it open to these things, and it is open to be used by political power brokers because of its popularity. That I don't think will ever leave us.
That's a great answer, mate. And there was a summation of why the political football podcast series was brought forward. I mean, you've just nailed it there, buddy. Any final thoughts, Stu?
No, it was a great answer. I think it's probably the best answer, certainly the most comprehensive answer we've had so far. I think, you know, like you said, Gary, it perfectly sums up why this series is now into its fourth version, 4.0. You know, of this series, you know, there's clearly so much, you know, it obviously dominates football, and it surrounds football, and it's so intertwined and bound up in each other that you just can't see any way of how it's going to untangle itself, if you like, in the near future.
Yeah, I agree. So I guess it's just comes now to just saying thanks to Aidan for coming on and sharing his knowledge and passion about the 1934 and 1938 World Cup Italy and Mussolini. So massive thanks to you, buddy.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been absolutely great. It's been a blast.
Thank you. Glad you enjoyed it. And Stu and myself will be back next time talking about another aspect of politics and football. You know, those two things are intertwined, very much as Aidan just described. So look out for us then. Thank you and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.